While the photographers are taking their pictures, I'm going to just take the opportunity to quickly tell you who is sitting in which seat. To my very far left is the producer, Luke Rogue. Next to him is the co-screenwriter, Rory Stewart Kinnear. Next is someone we know in the Cannes Film Festival for many good reasons, the actor Tilda Swinton. In the middle, the director and co-screenwriter, Lynn Ramsey. Then the actor who plays Kevin, Ezra Miller. And a national treasure back home in the United States, actor John C. Reilly. I'm going to start out with just one question or two, and then we'll take questions from the audience. If you could all settle down. The question is really for Lynn Ramsey and to some extent for Rory Stewart Kinnear. I know this is adapted from a prize-winning novel by Lionel Shriver, but this is one of the most intensely cinematic films that I've seen in its visual expressiveness, in its use of music contrapuntally. It doesn't feel like a book. I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little, for example, about even the color red, how it's interwoven throughout the film from beginning to end. What did the color red mean to you? Is that something from the novel or from you?
Where to start? I think because I can see films in my head, like in a very visual way. The book was letters, so obviously right away I said I can't do it like that. So I just saw Eva as the main character, as an unreliable narrator. And so I was choosing things she might go to inside herself. For me, it was a really interesting challenge in terms of structure. I've always done real-time before. I've never done non-linear. So it was trying to still tell a story but still make it feel very personal and very memory-like.
What about the red?
You know, and what about the red? The red. I'll speak about the red. Well, I thought one of the most striking and arresting images I liked from the novel was the house that was covered with the red paint. And I felt that she was in an episode of this place. You know, she's stuck in this place and it's the light is red and everything's red and it's reflecting. It's guilt. It's about guilt. The whole film's about guilt. Yeah.
The same for you with the screenplay. Did you approach it that way?
I do what Lynn tells me to do. It's much easier like that.
Okay. Come on, there is a gentleman on the aisle there.
Hello.
And then here.
Hugh Dyer from Belgian TV. Thank you for this brilliant movie. My question is for Tilda Swinton. Tilda, very pleased to see you again. In the book, it's like a long monologue because it's letters and we feel the inside thoughts of Eva. You choose no voice off. It's perfect, but for an actress, how to play such a range of emotions with few words, only with looks, with sometimes smiles, how to work on that without this interior voice?
I'm just trying to think how it could have been easier. I think words in many ways makes looking at life really complicated in the cinema. I'm of the belief that cinema went downhill since people started talking in it. I would have made any film that Lynn proposed we make together, but when she proposed this opportunity, one of the first things that I saw was an opportunity to be this interior and this lonely. And in many ways, I think that being a parent is like writing one long letter that you never send. If you've had enough sleep and if you're sort of relaxed enough, then you end up sending that letter to your child. But it generally gets lost in the post. And I think that feeling of being at the end of the day left with yourself. Of course, in Eva's case, it's extreme. It's like a nightmare scenario. But it's not that far from the everyday experience of being a parent, being really up against your own monologue, whoever you're talking to. So the lack of words and the feeling of isolation was, if anything, an easy thing in terms of the performance. Because it's not about facts, it's about feelings, this film. It's truly about emotion. I mean, when Lynn talks about the red, it's a bloody business having a family. It's certainly a very bloody business being a parent, and it's a really bloody business being a child, as we know. And I think that feeling of being the only thing that you can really hear, being your own pulse, your own blood beat, is really kind of the emotional soundtrack of the film.
A woman on the aisle, and then there were two questions right here.
Hello. A question for Lynn Ramsey. Thank you very much. This is for Caracol Television and W Radio from Colombia. I wanted to know why were you interested about telling this story, maybe the other side of the story of shootings and massacres we can see on TV. Why were you interested about the human relations that lead to that?
I think because families are so complicated, and certainly my own is as well. I think I was attracted a little bit because my brother and my mother had a very difficult relationship. I mean, it was a completely different scenario from this. But you saw that my mother would always, no matter how badly that my brother would treat her, you know, she would always be there for him, even if she didn't like him sometimes, you know. And I saw that bond was a very complex one. And also, I'm at the age of thinking about having a child myself and, you know, wondered some of these questions about responsibility and also that sometimes a child's born and you just don't know who that child is. It's nothing to do with the mum and dad sometimes, it's just they're that person. And I saw that in my own family, certainly. And so I think I was, when I read it, it appealed to me in that respect, yeah.
Okay. We had two here, one on the aisle, and then on the aisle at the back.
Hi there, it's Charlotte Higgins from The Guardian.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Charlotte.
So, Lynn, if I had made that film, I would probably not be now having any children. I don't know.
It didn't work.
I wonder how you feel about that. Celia was cute, but also dead. So it didn't turn out well for them, did it? And perhaps slightly more seriously, I wanted to ask you, Lynn, we've had a really long wait, a frustratingly long wait to see a piece of work by you, and we're delighted to have seen it. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that. And I know it was quite a long gestation period for this film that had various ups and downs on its route. And how do you feel about that? And
I think every film has ups and downs on its route. I think every filmmaker feels like they're, you know, pushing a boat over a mountain like Fitzcarraldo, you know. It's not really been that long, to be honest. I mean, I was on The Lovely Bones for like 5 years, like Peter Jackson did that, and you've all seen that, I'm sure. So,
or not.
I'm quite committed when I make a film and I like to make it perfect. So, you know, if it takes a long time to do that, then I'd rather take that time to have a fucking good, excuse my language, a really good script in front of me that I know is going to work, and that's why it's taking so long. And also, I think I've made 3 films in my head, so like I say, it's a 7th film for me, so there's a lot of other ones in here. So, yeah, it's been a long time, but that's elastic time, you know. It's been 5 years in another film. I've actually spent 4 years in this, I think, from book to screen, that's okay, especially with dark subject matter in these times that's going to be bold like this. Pretty strong, you know, pretty hard to get the finance sometimes for things like this, but we did it. Thank you.
It's not actually that long.
No, so I think it irritates me, this time thing sometimes, because you don't ask the guys that so much, I notice.
Okay, there was one here, then there are two in the middle, then gentlemen on the aisle, and then the gentleman behind.
Got that?
Farah Nayeri from Bloomberg. A question for Lynn Ramsey, actually a couple. Lynn, the book harps on a great deal about maternal ambivalence and the ambivalent feeling about the torn, mixed feelings about being a mother.
Yes.
And so much of the book is that. You haven't shown that too much. I mean, we see her being slightly creepy about other pregnant women, but you haven't dwelt on that. Why was that? And then the other question I had is, what's Lionel Shriver's reaction to the film?
Well, books and films are very different. It's like their first art. Yeah, but I think, you know, and obviously, you know, you can read between the lines in a book, you know, but I felt that I wanted to leave it up to the audience for Eva's character. I didn't want to make her just black and white. It's like, was she a bad mother? Was she not a bad mother? Was he a bad son? Was she, you know, so, you know, I approached it from that light. And Lionel loves the book, the film, I believe. So that's amazing. It doesn't often happen, actually, between a novel and a film, you know. So, but it's a very different thing. It's a very different thing. It's an emotional counter. It's a piece that is setting aside, different piece of work, yeah.
For those who don't know the book is very, very dense, and of course, as usual, there's so much that's not in the film, but I think it's maybe more representative to say that this film is inspired by the book.
I'd say inspired more, and also that I was going very much on an emotional journey with Eva that's more about feeling and image and thoughts and sensations, and I think hopefully we've achieved that, you know. So the film's very different from the novel, yeah. But I think Lionel approves. Yeah.
We'll hear about it if she doesn't.
I'm sure we will.
Bonjour, Anne Chaon, je travaille pour, I'm working for the Agence France Presse. I have a question for you, Ezra Miller. If I may ask you how old you are and how much do you feel connected with your character? And my question is, do you think there is any hope for this boy in this world? And according to you, what will he become in his life?
Is this a question for me?
Actually, this is for Ezra.
Thank you.
He's probably going to become like a clown or a mime or a comedian.
Or an actor.
I see. What were the questions? I'm 18 years old. To my horror, I do feel a little connected with Kevin. Always did. Always will. A bit. It's a little scary. Yeah, I think one of the very intense realities about being a human being is that all sorts of bad and all sorts of good exist within all of us. My approach to the film was, and to the character, was just finding those parts of myself. I mean, yeah, the conditions and circumstances of a person's life are going to make them who they are. So, I could have been Kevin.
That's a good title. I could have been Kevin.
A memoir.
Gentlemen on the aisle.
Hi, Baz Bammy Boy from the Mail. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Lynn Ramsey, nice to see you back.
Thanks, Baz.
In the movie biz. I was watching the movie and reading the book, I've always been concerned about how mothers are treated in culture, how they're sort of almost vilified. I'm just wondering what Tilda and Lynn think about that, and how Eva's, you know, she's treated, you know, so disdainfully by society, and she's left to hold to take the blame. And I'm just wondering.
It's a very interesting question. I think.
Yeah.
It's really true. I mean, one of the first things that we see in the film is Eva being smacked in the face, punched in the face by a complete stranger, to which her response is, it's my fault. Her house is plastered with red paint. In fact, the very first image we have of her is is of her being lifted up as in some kind of Christ position in a sea of red tomatoes.
Those
violent tomatoes. Yeah, it's really true. I mean, this film is not social commentary, but it happens to be true that, as far as I'm aware, that generally speaking, in situations where particularly a son is violent, it's always the mother's fault.
I think that's right. I think it was in the book, and something that we wanted to put in the film was because Eva feels so guilty and so responsible, she keeps herself in a situation where she's punished again and again because she feels like she deserves it. Yeah. That's why she goes and visits her son again and again, and that's why she stays in the same area where the thing happened and everyone knows who she was, because she doesn't feel like she deserves to escape from it. She deserves more and more punishment, so she brings it on herself.
But I think the reason for that, and this is where the film makes a really radical suggestion, is that I would suggest that maybe what's even more frightening for a woman than the idea of giving birth to an alien violence is the concept of giving birth to her own violence. She's violent. She is as violent as any of us are, no more, but certainly no less. And I think that one of the terrible kind of hog-tied positions that anyone who's just given birth to a child will find when they're sitting in a hospital bed.
I wish it was in a hotel again.
like in the movies when people have babies, and they're, you know, particularly in television films, when they're sitting in a hospital room and there's flowers everywhere and they're all powdered and made up magically and like this, and they have a baby and it's all really lovely, and they start getting, you know, pink baby clothes, and it's all just flowers. I mean, anyone who has been in that zone, even I suggest someone who's been to visit somebody who's in that zone, will know that that is fiction. And it's, as I say, a truly, truly murderous business, giving birth. And it brings, it's violent. It's a violent place to go. And it leaves, inevitably, if one doesn't embrace that, I think, if one can't embrace it, and it's really tough to do that, then you're up a gum tree, because it means you're going to be cutting off a whole part of yourself.
Gentleman there, and then we have one on that aisle and then one in the middle.
Peter Paul Hood, German Television. I have a question to Ezra Miller and John C. Reilly. I was wondering, Ezra, this kind of evil stare you give to the camera, where did you take it from? And I was wondering that this relationship between father and son seems to work out quite fine. And why? In the end, it doesn't. In the end, it doesn't.
It's hard for him.
Yeah, for me.
But
man.
He has quite a different kind of connection to his son. Wouldn't that have been a way of kind of saving themselves?
Sorry, what was the last part?
This report between the father and the son. Oh, was that something that could have saved the family and could have saved the Kevin character?
Can I answer that, actually, for just to begin with? No. Basically, I want you guys to talk about this, but it's a complex relationship between the father and son, because there's a lot of pretense there. But I think, Ezra, you should take that on board.
Yeah, Kevin, I feel from a very young age, is constantly manipulating his father, taking advantage of his father's endless, conditionless love, and using it essentially to his advantage in war with his mother. He views his dad as such a sap, such a total idiot. In the end, he actually has more respect for his mom. Shocking enough. I mean, he kills him. He's expendable. He's a total joke to Kevin, you know.
To me, I always thought it's like modern Greek tragedy, like Oedipus or something. You know, like he takes out the father because he wants his mother's love.
Right.
Yeah. Or at least her attention.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. I mean, the father pays attention to the son, and the mother's like looking over his shoulder at some Ecuadorian hill.
And you know, that makes him angry at both of them. It's not just towards the mother. It's the whole situation.
The way I thought of the father was that he wasn't oblivious to this, you know, disdain from his son, but like a lot of parents, and I think myself included, you just keep pushing on. And in some ways, you see the infant. No matter what age the child is, you still see the infant that you're responsible for. It's that same face. And so, you're doing your best, but you are your own collection of flaws and you know, psychological makeup is, you know, causing you to do things your own way. But I don't think he was oblivious to Kevin's disdain. I think he just felt responsible for him, and the go-to move was unconditional love. And to speak to you, your question about whether that affection between the two of them could have saved the family, I don't think it was capable of that. I think it was more of a coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. Like the way that Tilda's character coped with the situation was she went to battle with it every day, and the way that my character coped with the situation was he just tried to make everything nice. And maybe if I just act like everything's okay, everything will become okay. And I think both of those approaches are very common.
And also so tragic. That's so tragic. That's what I really love in Franklin's character. It's so tragic. He's just trying to make everything okay. He's a good guy, you know. So, and John brought so much warmth to this character, I think, that it made it more three-dimensional to me than in the novel.
We have over there in the back, then the woman here in the middle, and then gentleman down here, and then in the back.
Hi, Kate Muir from The Times.
Hiya.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about the decision to turn the camera away from the carnage. You don't show any of that in the gym. And at what point you sort of made that decision? And my second question is country and Western music and your ironic use of it. Could you tell us about that?
We didn't have a lot of money to do a big set piece, you know. But also beyond that, I felt like we should keep it in Eva's point of view. Like, she never saw that. She can only imagine it. And your imagination is so much worse than the event. So she never sees inside the gym. She can never see what really happened. She can only project it. And that nightmare is something she has to live with every day. Because this is not just, you know, people that are her son is killed, she's killed them by proxy. So it's a really weird nightmare. So that was part of the decision. It was also a budget decision. We didn't have any, you know. So it's been clever about how you do these things and make them feel kind of, you know, very like epic, but very, very much I thought about it from her point of view and what she actually saw and what she didn't see and what was in her mind. And then in terms of the music, I feel it's a chain gang kind of thing. She's on an internal chain gang. And Lonnie Donegan just seemed to work. And he's from Glasgow, actually, so that was quite nice, you know. But it's a definite chain gang kind of feeling. I'm on the Americana chain gang. And I guess I was kind of thinking along those lines. Yeah, that's about it. Yeah.
Okay. In the middle.
Yes, it works. Hi, I'm Marissa from Metro TV Indonesia. I have two questions for Ms. Ramsey and one question for Mr. Riley. To Ms. Ramsey, so at the end, do you think it's nature or nurture? And also, you used... the second question is you put a bit of Japanese music as well.
It's actually Chinese.
Oh, it's Chinese.
It's Lu Fang. She's a fantastic musician. She plays a pipa. Is it five strings?
Yeah. It's three.
Three. Oh, sorry. Yeah. You know, he's a musician. it was to me, when I heard that music, it was like a love story, and it was also like a Western. And that's kind of how I saw the film. It was like a war and a perverse love story.
The track that she plays in the film is called Ambush.
And it's called Ambush.
It tells the story, an ancient Chinese story, of a man who was desperately in love with his wife and is attacked and killed. And the music tells that story without words. And so that conflict for this film was perfect.
And she played live as well. She came to London, and Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead recorded her. And
it was one of the most beautiful days of my life listening to her play.
I think they both cried at the end.
Yeah.
And is it nature or nurture, do you think?
I think the film is asking that question, so I need to put that back to you guys. You
know? All right. Thank you. And for Mr. Riley, what made you decide that you wanted to be involved in this film? Because previously you were involved in Cyrus, which was brilliant, by the way. And your character was, Cyrus was lighter compared to this one. This one is really dark. What made you want to be involved in this darker movie?
Well, I mean, interested in working with great filmmakers, and Lynn, you know, I was speaking to my agent one day, and I said, well, I want to work with some great, I want to work with the next great director. So here's a list of people, and the first name was Lynn Ramsey, and he's, well, actually, she's got a script that she's just written, and Tilda Swinton's doing it, and so, yeah, I'd been a, I mean, I think Lynn is one of the greatest directors.
I feel really flattered by that, because I think he's one of the best actors.
Ah, go on.
So I'm just going to kiss your arse as well.
But I guess if you're asking, like, I've done some comedies recently, and why I was drawn towards this, I'm always drawn to the thing that I didn't just do, you know. So I think variety is an important part of why I choose things. But it was really Lynn. Like, I think Tilda said earlier she would have done anything that Lynn presented, and I was the same way. I was just dying to work with her, and I said, well, I don't even care what the script is. If there's a part for me, please sign me up.
Gentleman here.
Thomas Siemienski. I work for the Polish Public Radio. The question is for Lynn Ramsey. First of all, I noticed an incredible beauty of the images in your film. But don't you think there is kind of gap between the beauty of aesthetic beauty of the images and the brutality, the violence of the story you are telling?
That's a big question. Beauty, violence, we've got something, there's a beauty in violence, I guess. It's a really hard thing for me to say. I definitely didn't want to show something, you know, over the top, gratuitous violence. There's no violence in this film, you only see aftermath. There's only aftermath. Every Hollywood movie is violent, much more violent than this. That's why I find it surprising if people find it so violent, because you don't see any violence, you know. In terms of images, I just think in images and I think in sounds, and that's what a filmmaker is. So, you know, I'm not a novelist. I don't write books. You know, I write in images, and you know, work. I think we work. Yeah, really.
I think there's something more shocking about seeing beauty next to horror. That's what makes it so powerful. Is, you know, that you can see something absolutely disgusting, and there are still beautiful things surrounding it, and it's that contrast that makes the film powerful. I think. I hope.
And also, it occurs to me that maybe that's a part of it, and I do believe it's unconscious in the film, because I think that Lynn is such an instinctive filmmaker that she would make an image without even being able to assess it in a way.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think that maybe, and it only just occurs to me now, maybe that's a part, and we'll see as the film plays out. You're the first audience to have ever seen it. Maybe that will be a useful part of the experience of seeing a film, feeling one's response to the beauty and then feeling the guilt of the response to the beauty. It might be a part of attaching an audience to the film. I don't know. We'll see.
It creates some of the anxiety and tension in the film.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. Question right here.
Hi, Chaz Ebert from Ebert Presents at the Movies. This question is for Tilda Swinton. You won an Academy Award for Michael Clayton, and yet you still pull a 33-ton portable cinema through the Scottish Highlands for your Tilda Perambulating Traveling Film Festival. Can you tell us why you do that?
Why do you do that?
Well, why not? You know, I live in the Highlands of Scotland, but you don't have to live in the Highlands of Scotland to live in cinema-free areas. There are many inner city areas all over the world that have cinema-shaped gaps, and we have to travel quite far to go to see a big screen where we live, and then we get to see a multiplex experience on about 17 screens of Harry Potter. So it occurred to us that maybe to carry, in fact, a 43-ton truck from the west coast to the east coast of Scotland and stop off in various places where, you know, people had never seen Bresson or Les Blancs or Sullivan's Travels.
I was really pleased you took my first film to China.
We dubbed Ratcatcher, subtitles Ratcatcher into Mandarin. I'm proud of this. This is an achievement.
I'm so proud it was shown. I think it had quite a good response.
Yeah, great response.
And yeah, so it was really interesting. I'd love this film to be shown in China too, you know. So
not many subtitles needed. No. On this one.
but we'll see. It might be hard getting this dark subject matter past the censors. We'll see.
But in short, Chaz, because there are film fans everywhere, and in every Highland Glen, there's somebody willing to see something subtitled from, you know, Parajanov. And, you know, it's my honour and pleasure to pull it to them.
Yeah, definitely. Go, girl.
gentleman here in the middle. Or was there another person on that? This gentleman first, and then you in back. And I didn't see
Hi,
you.
Hi, this is Yanis from Greece. Easy question to anyone can answer that. It's a tragic background, but it's an optimistic feeling at the end. Was that subconscious, or was it something that was
It was very
fabricated in a way beforehand? I mean,
well, it was a.
People want redemption in the movies, you know. If you don't have a happy ending, then no one goes to see it. So we had to give them a happy ending.
Well, happy ending. I don't know.
A nearly happy ending.
No, I really thought the last scene was very key to the whole thing. It was almost like, you know, the first time they really do speak, the first time there is any honesty, and it might be a really tragic sense of honesty and painful. And it's the first time she holds her son. So it was a big scene. It was completely planned out. Yeah, definitely. It was a key scene for the film, actually. And we didn't have enough time to shoot it. I got really angry that day. I got very angry. I think I stormed off set quite a few times because I really wanted to, you know, it was important to me. A lot of other stuff we were meant to shoot that day, and I had to just get it off because this was the key scene, you know. And I had to, you know, make sure people understood that.
Actually, if I can build on that question for a second, the way that Eva cleans her house and puts everything away, it's as if she's going to leave that house. She's leaving it for the next person. I got the feeling that at least she's now going to be able to walk away. That was the only moment of sort of upbeat ending that I assumed. Is that sort of correct?
I thought
she committed suicide. It's always dark as all
that. I think that it's
she's
what Lynn says about... That there is a new opening. There's a new beginning, in fact. For the first time, these two people encounter each other. For me, that final scene in the prison is linked to the first scene when she's holding the baby. The baby is screaming, and what is she doing? She's remembering what it said in some childcare book about smile at your baby. You know, that's the beginning of the disconnect, and the disconnect never ends until this scene when she asks him a question with real honesty, why? And he answers with real honesty, I don't know. And there's a beginning. They now can have a relationship. It's taken its time. And there's been some collateral damage. But, you know, they now have a chance. He will come back to that house, to that room, to that copy of Robin Hood. And they can go on. So it is hopeful.
Okay. Gentlemen here, and then on the far side here.
Yes, I'm Kuo from Sinakong, China. I have a question for Ms. Ramsey. Your film reminds me of Gus Van Sant's Elephant some years ago. Okay. But your approach is completely different. I mean, it's more centered upon the relation between mother and son, or the violence between them, or the suppressing of violence between them. Mm-hmm. What I want to know is, do you think there's a relation between the violence that in our society now and the violence that exists between family itself?
Well, I think it's really interesting. That's a very interesting question. I think it's really interesting. You know, that Kevin comes from quite a middle class, you know, American background. I mean, he's got everything, you know, he has it all, but he doesn't have a lot of purpose. And I think that's one thing that, you know, these kids that do these things tend to be, you know, middle class. It's like they're not like coming from a bad, broken home, you know, poor home. They tend to have this rage inside them. I think that there's a It reflects partly a society where there's a spoilt child in the room. We keep feeding the child, and it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger until he overtakes us. So, in some sense, I made this metaphor in the film about our society too, that we're ignoring the spoilt child. We're ignoring this child. We're giving it, we're feeding it, and we're not slapping it. So I guess, there's a violence that in Kevin that's about a bigger violence, which is about the violence in the world, I think, you know, which is to turn a blind eye to what's happening. You're going to create monsters. Monsters are happening all over the world. So that was, it was kind of what I did think about that.
I think Elephant is a film about a high school killing. This is a film about a family, and the high school killing is a smokescreen that Ezra, Kevin, constructs to give his mum a surprise when she gets home. It's not about that for him. That's just his piece of art for his mum. You know, everything in this story is about their relationship and their relationship with Franklin, not really about what happens at high schools.
And Elephant's a terrific film, but this is really not about that. Yeah. It's not about high school killing. That's a definitive film about high school killing. This film is a film about a mother and son.
I remember when we were preparing it, there were moments when we fantasised about alternate titles. And not only because Luke Rogue is one of our producers, but I remember we talked a lot about a potential for it to be called Performance. Because it is really... The film, more than the book, but the film really does deal with this concept of artifice, of disconnect within a family, of people just saying, just acting roles, acting the role of the father. Hey, buddy, you know, where does that come from? I don't know, but there's obviously a cue card somewhere which says that that's what fathers say when they come home from work. And there are all sorts of cue cards for mothers too. And that feeling for Kevin that they're all faking it, and he wants them to connect with him. He wants their attention. And he wants to actually communicate with him. He's super bright. And that can be a really lonely, lonely place to be when people are kind of faking it with you.
I also try to reflect that a lot in the look of the film, that it has a veneer, like a sheen in the family, you know, especially the past life, that feels kind of phony, like a set. You know? So,
like the ranch house.
Yeah. Mm.
Okay. Gentlemen there.
Hi, Anthony Bresnahan from Entertainment Weekly. As a relatively new dad myself, I watched this sort of gripping the edge of my seat. Yeah, and it played almost like a horror film to me, and I hope that doesn't sound trite.
No, it doesn't. Actually, I wanted to make a psychological horror film.
Yeah, it just seemed, I mean... one thing that horror stories do is they purge these fears that we have. And you talked about thinking about having a family yourself at the beginning of this press conference. And though this movie isn't one that aims to supply any answers, I wondered, you know, for John and Lynn and Tilda, whether as potential parents or as parents, you came to any closer understanding or realization about the prospect of raising a child.
I think for me I have. I mean, it's a big question having kids, but...
Don't buy your son a crossbow.
Don't buy your son a crossbow. No, I think it's about... I don't know, I come from, I don't even know if I want to talk about my background, but it's basically, you know... But my mom was there a lot for us, you know, and I think you've got to spend, you know, what it makes me see is that you've got to spend a lot of time with your kids, especially in the first 3 years, you know, and that you can reflect a lot... of your own, you can project a lot of your own fears onto a child. It'll really pick that up. And I've seen that. I really believe that, you know. And my mum, who's a brilliant, you know, had four kids, and she is completely comfortable with kids. I mean, you can see when she picks up a baby, she feels comfortable. And then you can see when you know, other people have noticed that when they don't feel comfortable, the baby really picks that up, you know. It really, you know, so I think it's really complex business, having been a parent. It really is. But I don't say shunting it off to a nanny is a very good thing. No, I don't think so myself, you know. But anything to say in that? Anyway.
This will be the last question.
I'm Liam Lacey from the Globe and Mail in Toronto. Uh-huh. This is a question for both screenwriters. There's this image of family violence, the sins passed down from one generation to the rest... interesting sort of totem things that seem to crop up in the film, eye patch, arrows, stuff like that. I'm curious if there were specific, for example, Greek mythology ideas that you were working with.
Oedipus Rex you know? And Oedipus wrecks this family. And that's definitely, you know, a story that was very, very clearly, you know, represented in the book, and something that I think will stand the test of time. It's a classic story, and weirdly one that's not been covered in cinema very much. I think the idea of a mother not loving her son is one of the last taboos, and people don't want to talk about it. And we've shown that in this film. But definitely it is a Greek tragedy in its essence, you know.
I actually really agree with that. Nothing else to say on that point, actually.
Also in its form, I would suggest. Yeah. You remember, I mean, the questions about, you know, violence happening on screen, this closed environment. I mean, it's just a family. It's not like they have a lot of friends over for dinner. And there is a chorus, and the chorus is outside the school. And it has that... It, you know, it is, as I said, it is not social commentary, this. It has the cathartic end that Greek tragedy does also. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.